Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me. And I wanted you to know about a number of things. I recently launched a brand new nonprofit called Responsible Eating and Living. Our website is responsibleeatingandliving.com, and I hope you will check out the site. Let me know what you think of it, and I hope it grows into a community that makes eating and living a joyful, nourishing, happy experience without any dangerous side effects. And if you have any comments or questions during the show or any time during the week, you can contact me at info@realmeals.org. Now, as you know, I talk very often all the time about food. That's my favorite subject, and how our food choices affect our health and the environment and the treatment of animals. And so much of what's related to what we put in our body through food and through the air we breathe and the clothes we wear and the products that we put on ourselves and through everything that is in our environment around us gets into our bodies. And some of it's good, and some of it is not so good. And we're going to talk a lot about that today. I have a really incredible guest. I feel very privileged to have this hour to speak with her. Biologist and poet Sandra Seingraber, PhD, is the author of Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood. Toronto Star said, lyrical, funny, toughly scientific, and unflinchingly truthful. And Living Downstream, An Ecologist's Personal Investigation of Cancer and Environment. The Chicago Tribune said, an important, deeply felt book. And now the subject of an award-winning documentary. Seingraber has provided congressional briefings, tested before the President's Cancer Panel, and spoken in the European Parliament. For her research and writing, she has received the Rachel Carson Leadership Award from Chatham College, the Environmental Health Champion Award from the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and from Healthy Child, Healthy World, the Mom on a Mission Award for Prevention. A scholar in residence at Ithaca College, she is a columnist and contributing editor at Orion Magazine. She lives with her husband and children in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York and has a terrific website, www.steingraber.com. Welcome, Sandra.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, gosh, I am just overwhelmed because you have done such amazing work. And I just finished reading Raising Elijah, and there's so much incredible information in here. And what's especially good about it is you are a wonderful storyteller.
And oh, well, I work hard on that, so thank you.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't imagine how you wrote this book and the books that you wrote prior to this one. There's a lot of very difficult, upsetting information, and you bring it all with clarity and humor and make it readable, which is really important.
Well, I think there's nothing worse than a book full of disturbing things that would just sit on a shelf somewhere. So I wanted to create a compelling enough story to seduce my readers through some fairly difficult science and keep reading because they wanted to see how the story turned out.
Yeah, and I want to believe that we all have happy endings despite all the horrible things that are going on. Yeah.
Well, Raising Elijah is, of course, based on the life of my own 9-year-old son, so the span of the story starts with his birth and takes you up to his 9th birthday. And he's a very kind of funny child, and so some of the humor is provided just by his own life. And Elijah himself is named after an abolitionist from Illinois, not far from where I grew up, Elijah Lovejoy, who was a very big hero of mine as a child. He, in the 1830s, advocated for the abolition of slavery at a time when slaves were really a big part of people's personal wealth. It was like investing in mm-hmm. real estate in the 1990s. And so to call for the end to slavery and not compensate slave owners for all of this wealth was a really radical idea at the time, and he was assassinated ultimately, but his words lived on and actually were inspiration for other abolitionists who actually then kind of did get our economy divorced from a ruinous dependency on slavery. So I call in Raising Elijah for divorcing our economy from its dependency on fossil fuels, and I believe that parents should be front and center of that battle.
Absolutely. It just seems that so many of the battles we have are linked to the economy, and slavery is one example. But the issues that we face today are, well, they seem to me so much more of a problem. It could be just because they're in my lifetime, but because they affect all of us in ways that we can't avoid. You know, back in the days of slavery, I could have chosen, at the very least, not to have slaves and not to participate in that activity. But today, with all of the industry and products that are out there today, we can't avoid drinking the water that may contain contaminants. We can't avoid breathing the air that has things in it that aren't beneficial to our health.
Well, it's true. I think it is easy when we look back at the problems that used to exist to believe because they have been conquered, that they're sort of less pervasive. But at the time, I think, even people living in the North knew that they were benefiting from slavery because it was keeping the cost of goods down.
Mm.
In the same way that even if you don't live in Appalachia, you might heat your house with coal today, right? And
right.
So even though you can choose not to be a coal miner yourself or blow up your own mountains, you're still benefiting from fossil fuels. And so I think that the economic argument, which I tried to deploy in Raising Elijah, is to find metrics to talk about the hidden costs of how we do things. For example, 1 in 8 U.S. children is born premature now, and prematurity is actually the leading cause of death among in the first few months of life. It's the leading cause of disability in this nation,
mm-hmm.
which makes it the most expensive human health problem to have because its effects last for a lifetime. And it has a price tag of $26 billion per year in medical costs. And we know certain chemical exposures are linked to preterm birth, most specifically living near busy roads and breathing in a lot of traffic exhaust. So the more air pollution a mother's exposed to, the higher her risk for preterm birth. And so, you know, running an economy that involves a lot of diesel exhaust, it seems cheap, but actually adds rocks to the pocket of our healthcare system. And then by the time you end up adding other morbidities of childhood like asthma, learning disabilities, attention deficit disorders, autism, early puberty in girls, all of these things have multiple causes, but the environment is demonstrably contributing to some proportion of those,
mm-hmm.
and they all have billion-dollar price tags. So suddenly it doesn't look so economically sensible to use fossil fuels to do things.
Well, I know many people who have succeeded have had tremendous skill at playing around with their economic spreadsheet and making things look more attractive than they really are until some things finally kind of fall apart. But do you see some change in the last few years where we're not so short-sighted?
Well, I do, and I see parents in particular realizing that we can't be our own environmental protection agencies. We can't
mm-hmm.
be our own poison control centers. That, you know, none of us, however conscientious we might be, are HEPA filters. We can't stand between the bodies of our children and all the contaminants in air, food, and water.
By the way, that's I just wanted to say that's my favorite line in the book. I am a conscientious parent. I am not a HEPA filter.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think it shows us that we really need to demand a kind of redesign of our materials economy and our systems of energy to align them with healthy child development. And happily, I think the news here is it's very doable. so the funnest chapters for me to write were the food chapters, because organic agriculture has demonstrated it can feed the world with high yields, on par now with conventional farms. So the old idea that we, you know, either have to choose between poisoning people or people starving, that's no longer the case. Maybe that was true in the 60s and 70s. It's certainly not the case now. So choosing to source with local organic farmers is something that is a personal lifestyle choice, but it also has big political transformational implications, because we all have to eat anyway, and by redirecting our food dollars toward local organic farmers, we're decreasing the amount of carbon that's burned, and we're also protecting our own children from pesticide residues, which are known to be linked to things like learning disabilities and small birth weight and other problems. And as far as I could see, all the problems that I deal with in the book, somebody somewhere has figured out a solution for. I was just in Boston yesterday and sat down with a lot of green chemists and other people who work on a field called biomimicry, in which engineers design products that mimic animals in the real world.
Yeah, I've been reading. I love some of that.
Yeah, and there's just so many elegant, beautiful solutions that don't involve shoveling fossils into an oven and lighting them on fire. And so the key is, how do we insist on those? How do we bring them out of the alternative world and into the mainstream? And so I offer some ideas for that in Raising Elijah.
I love technology, and there's so much that we've been able to do with it that has benefited all of us. But at the same time, technology has also come at a price, and there are numerous things that have come out of it that have been really harmful. And so on one hand, I want to believe, yes, there's so much creativity out there, and yes, we can solve any problem. And I really believe that. The question is, will we be able to do it in time? You know, will something happen before it's too late? Because there are so many really depressing things that you bring up in your book about the fall in IQs in young children because of the chemicals that they're exposed to in the womb and then in their early development, and how their brains are so vulnerable and unprotected. And then you wonder, well, is the next generation going to be smart enough to solve any of these really complicated problems?
Well, sure. It brings up all kinds of big, disturbing questions. My hope is that people don't get so hung up on the, you know, is it too late question, that it prevents them from putting one foot in front of the other and just doing something. And it's my experience that the most difficult problem to overcome is people's sense of futility. I mean, people are looking for all kinds of reasons not to engage forcefully with these issues. And one of them is, it's too late. You know, and another one is, my voice doesn't matter. And another one is, the government only listens to the corporation. And so people have all kinds of reasons to do nothing. And that's harder for me actually to deal with than, you know, what I just dealt with last month, which was debating a gas industry representative at the Cornell Law School. You know, I feel like I can win on the science. I'm unafraid of industry opposition. But trying to convince people that this isn't a losing battle, that there's a place for heroism here, and we're placing our children at such needless risk, because actually the solutions are among us. We just have to insist on capitalizing them. That's a harder battle for me to fight.
I want to talk about that a bit more, because I think that is our biggest obstacle. Because I believe the solutions exist, and I also believe that we can make them all work in the economy, and I think they'll be good for the economy. Actually.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm convinced of that too.
Because of all of these hidden costs that we accept and carry the burden and use, quote, solutions that are costly to solve some of these problems that don't solve the problems. They're just dealing with symptoms. And I really think there's a beautiful option out there.
Well, there are, for things big and small. And so in Raising Elijah, I try to deal with them on every level, and hopefully with some amount of humor. So in my own family, for example, I decided to get rid of the clothes dryer. And I did it on a whim, and I'm the mother of two young children. I work full-time, and I actually travel 100 days of the year. So I don't think, you know, anyone can be busier than I am, and yet I figured out how to wait not to have a clothes dryer. And so I'm not interested in making my life more inconvenient. I mean, I barely get enough sleep the way it is. So if it actually took more time to not have a clothes dryer, there's just not a spare minute in my life for inconvenience. But what I discovered was that if you, for example, use clothes hangers rather than clothespins, and my husband came up with this sort of brilliant thing where he strung clotheslines, retractable clotheslines like violin strings across our stairwell where we hang clothes at night. If I put them right on the hangers and let them dry, they can dry while they sleep. So, yes, it takes longer, but if I'm sleeping, that's not any more time.
Right.
Moreover, they're already hung on the hangers because when you actually take clothes out of a dryer, which I now see as kind of a clothing randomizer, you don't have a neatly folded basket of clothes. You have clothes that have to be sorted and folded, and socks have to be matched. And so there's another 20 minutes at least. So I did this whole ergonomic analysis of the dryer versus the hangers, and I discovered if you mate and as you hang and put everybody's clothes in the same, you know, together, and put the socks together and hang them on the hangers, then it doesn't take any longer at all. What it does mean is that when the kids then take their clothes and put them in the closet, their pajamas are on hangers instead of neatly folded in little bundles. But as far as I'm concerned, that's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. You're preaching to the choir here. I'm one of these strange people here who lives in New York City in an apartment that doesn't use a dryer. And I do it with joy. I find it's kind of a zen-like experience when I'm taking the clothes out of the laundry machine and hanging them up on these racks inside the apartment. And of course we have these crazy rules where we're not allowed to hang clothes outside here because it kind of makes the neighborhood look less classy or something. I don't know.
Yeah, we should get over that. In fact, I just had a photographer over doing an interview right before you gave me a call, and she wanted to photograph me in my yard, but I had laundry hanging, so she was trying to figure out how she could photograph me without showing the laundry. I said, what are you kidding? This is not a sign of shame, you know?
Yeah.
Laundry hanging in the air, let the laundry, you know, like prayer flags hanging out there, let them be in the photograph. So I think just in the same way we had to denormalize tobaccos, right? So now my kids see cigarettes as this grotesque thing. They don't see it as glamorous. I think the reverse needs to happen to the clothesline. It needs to not be seen as this, somehow this sign of poverty and shame, but it should be seen as sort of like eco-chic and edgy and cool. And so the more of us who start to hang and normalize the clothesline, the better.
Absolutely. You know, and it's not hard, and there's a way to fit it in your schedule. My question is, how did we get so soft? How did we get so lazy? The United States of America, now, I don't want to go too much into our history because some of it I'm not too proud of when, you know, we blew away all the Indians. But the DNA of the people that came over to America were courageous and adventurous and energetic and risk takers, and we're not that anymore. And you know, there was a time with President Kennedy when he decided we should go to the moon, and everybody kind of geared up and focused on this task, and we got there. And we're just not doing that anymore. Everything is just too much trouble. It's too difficult. You know, I don't know how to inspire people otherwise, because it really isn't too difficult. I live this life and I enjoy it, and I don't know how to get people to change. You say that you want government to change some of the rules with EPA and whatever, so that we're not using fossil fuels in the ways that we are, and we're not creating all these toxic chemicals. But individuals are so much a part of this equation.
They are, and that's the good and bad news of it, right? So when it comes to fossil fuels, 1,000 molehills really do a mountain make. So a lot of the carbon that is burned right at the level of the individual household. So that's, in fact, that's like 38% of our emissions. And so redesigning the individual household is going to be part of the battle. So I think that there are actually lots of examples of really inspirational things going on there. And part of my role as a science writer at this moment in human history is to profile some of those great examples of people who are doing things differently. And I think the movement here has begun with food. People are really interested in knowing where their food comes from.
Yeah.
And who grows it, and they're seeing the connections. And from there now, I'm seeing a real curiosity about the origins of other things. My 12-year-old, for example, is interested in fighting for her right for non-toxic nail polish. and so there's a whole group of really radical middle school girls out there who realize that the European Union has passed laws that prohibit toxic chemicals in personal care products like nail polish and hair gel and conditioners and deodorants. Yet those same global companies are marketing the toxic formulations here in the United States because we don't have those kind of strict laws.
Well, we do the same thing to other countries, to pesticides and herbicides that have been made illegal, the handful of them in this country. We sell them out to other countries, and we buy their food back.
Well, that is true. Increasingly, however, other countries are tightening up their restrictions, and we're becoming the dumping grounds for including pesticides like atrazine, which are no longer allowed to be used in other countries. So we're becoming the third world dumping grounds for a lot of different things. And so middle school girls have actually made public the formulas for the non-toxic products in Europe that we could have here if we demanded them, right? So they're taking up that issue. And I've worked with football players who are actually really interested in insisting on organic football fields. And I learned from them that the little brown mushrooms that spring up on playing fields are actually a health and safety threat to especially linebackers because they're slippery and they can lead to knee injuries from when you do a lot of lateral movement with mushrooms on the field. And so, but most fungicides are male reproductive toxicants. And so how to do fungal control on football fields without using these chemicals requires cooperation between the mycologists and the, you know, athletic directors. And that's actually happening on some college campuses. So I see people really interested in tracing the origins of things, whether it's their clothing or their cosmetics or their food. I see people asking, could we perform this task differently? Do we need a toxic chemical to get to the same place? So I think it's a really exciting time. And the system, unfortunately, right now is gamed to make the toxic solution usually cheaper than the non-toxic solution, and that's only because of a process of subsidies and ignoring the externalized costs like human health costs. And so I think there's just a lot of room for sensible reform here, and increasingly people are asking for it.
Well, I always like to look at the bright side, and although a lot of people are very nervous about the economy, I do believe that when we are in difficult times like this, that's when the innovation comes out, because when we're most comfortable, we don't think about change. And so this is a time of great opportunity.
It is, and it's a time of an incredible crossroads. So if you ever wanted to feel like you lived in an amazing period of time, you're actually in one, because as we right now we are realizing that we have run through most of the easy-to-get fossil fuels. We've already kind of excavated them from their fossil-y graveyards. And what's left is the really hard-to-get stuff. So we are now preparing to blast those difficult-to-get fossil fuels out of the ground, and that requires increasingly more extreme and toxic methods of extraction. And that includes mountaintop removal, where you actually blow up mountains to get at the last seams of coal. It includes deep-sea oil drilling, as we saw with BP. It includes tar sands removal, where we actually cut down forests in Alberta, Canada, and cook the tar out of the soil itself and send them down pipelines to New Orleans. And here in the Northeast, it includes fracking. which is probably the most evil of them all. It involves blowing up the bedrock beneath our feet to liberate bubbles of methane, so-called natural gas, which can only come to the surface when millions of gallons of fresh water are mixed with tens of thousands of gallons of toxic chemicals for every well, and tens of thousands of wells have to be spread out across the landscape because you don't get very much gas out of any one well. So you're going to industrialize our organic farms and cut down the last remaining intact forests of the Northeast to blast bubbles of methane out of the ground. This is the proposal. And so we can either keep going down this road, or we can say, look, you know, this is ultimately a dead end, because by definition, non-renewable resources are, you know, they're non-renewable. God's not putting any more of them in the ground.
Who thinks of these things?
Now do something different and invest in renewables.
Who thinks of these things? That's what's so crazy.
Well, I mean, Halliburton is the one that pioneered so-called fracking for shale gas, and that's important because Dick Cheney was the CEO of Halliburton and then became the vice president and convened his energy panel. He was able then, as vice president, to exempt fracking from all federal laws. So it's not under the jurisdiction of the EPA. It does not have to abide by the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Right to Know laws, and so forth. And so it's only under the control of the state governments. And so here in the Northeast, of course, Pennsylvania as a state has decided to completely open the floodgates and has thousands of wells in production and on the books, whereas here in New York, we have a temporary moratorium on fracking. So it's almost like New York and Pennsylvania are twins separated at birth. One has temporarily banned it, and the other has
totally embraced it.
And so as our temporary moratorium in New York runs out at the end of this month, the big question is, what will Governor Cuomo decide to do? Will the moratorium be lifted? Will it be permitted? Will it be prohibited? And we see the gas industry just sure that it will have its way with us, so they're already staging grounds on the border with some of the biggest corporations in the world just massing there waiting to kind of plunder the landscape. And at the same time, we see this very robust anti-fracking movement rising up at every level. Some are working on banning it at the individual village level. Some are working on the federal level. And some are farmers who are worried about losing their organic certification if fracking comes with all of the toxic chemicals. And so there's this very powerful anti-fracking movement. And it's kind of like watching a steamroller heading for a brick wall. I have no idea, you know, how this is going to turn out, but it's this amazing human drama right here. So if you ever wanted a chance to play hero, you know, here's this moment in history where we're either going to pursue more catastrophically horrible fossil fuel extraction, or we're going to say stop, and now is the time to invest in wind and
do you know
solar.
Where people can go in the New York area to, is there like a good website or somewhere to petition against the fracking?
Oh, there is. I mean, this is an all-hands-on-deck moment, and so Governor Cuomo just really needs to hear from all of us this week. This week. And the legislature it's the last week the legislature is in session, and there are some bills that are actually on the being proposed, one that would ban fracking altogether, one that would extend the moratorium. So these all need help. So I guess there's a number of websites. One in New York City is Frack Action. That's a good place to go. Also, Food and Water Watch has a new report out on the health hazards of fracking that just came out this week. Food and Water Watch has a big New York City presence. Catskill Mountain Keepers is working hard. And here in the Finger Lakes area where I live, Toxics Targeting has a wonderful website that has a letter that you can sign to Governor Cuomo and some of the others. So you can go to any of those websites. Toxics Targeting, I think, is really going after Governor Cuomo on this.
And if the worst case scenario occurs, then our last option is when they start to destroy things, we just have to lay down our bodies, right, to try and make
them
stop.
There are people who are talking that way, and you know, I feel that I, at this point, I just can't look that far down the road. I don't want to believe that this is inevitable. And I think that's part of the game here, that the fracking companies act as though this is a fait accompli, that there's nothing to be done to stop it, and that's part of how they've made people throw up their hands and feel this sort of sense of fatalism about it. But I've been part of so many other industrial activities in which that kind of mantle of inevitability was part of the game. For example, in my own home state of Illinois, there were municipal waste incinerators that were floated, and we were told there was no doubt about it that by the year 2000 there would be 9 incinerators scattered across the cornfields of Illinois. There are none. And the reason is a bunch of farmers with eighth grade education got really interested in the pharmacokinetics of dioxin and what it meant for their hogs and their children and their turkeys, and they passed referendum after referendum saying no on a village level. And finally, the governor changed the law that made it profitable to generate electricity from burning garbage, and all the incinerator companies went away. So I think that that kind of model that I'm hoping will happen here in New York, it's clear to a lot of us that the environmental health effects of fracking that will add so many health problems to the role of Medicare and Medicaid in the form of more preterm birth from all the smog, more learning disabilities from the release of heavy metals like mercury and lead, more cancers, more asthma, more heart disease, filling our rural roads up with fleets of tanker trucks carry hazmat, teaching our children how to drive on roads meant for buggies that are now filled with 18-wheelers, you know, that this is just not safe on any level, and the price that we'll pay for fixing the roads, for first responders, for emergency rooms, for everything, is just going to more than wipe out whatever profits are made from this. So it makes no sense economically if we're a public health perspective. I had the opportunity to testify in the New York Assembly recently on the health effects of fracking, and my feeling was that the committee members were asking me very good questions about, you know, what they were convinced of the latest study by a team from Duke University showing high levels of methane in drinking water near where gas is being drilled. And what does that mean when we chlorinate that water? Does it make trihalomethanes, which are carcinogens? What does it mean when you add detergent to that water and send it downstream and somebody else drinks it? And so they were asking kind of all the right questions. So we'll see what happens. But it feels to me a lucky moment for me as a biologist to be engaged with this enormous human rights movement that sprung up in the form of the anti-fracking resistance.
Well, we're certainly fortunate to have you to be a part of it. We need to take we need to take a quick break, but I have so many more things that I want to talk to you about. So can you stay with us, and we'll
be
right
to.
Back. Thank you. Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food, and I'm here with Sandra Steingraber, whose new book, Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis, is out, and I've read it, and I recommend it to everyone as a must-read. Sandra, thank you for joining me this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Have you ever considered politics?
I feel like I'm a shy person, and I am happy to write about everything I know about the environmental health risks of whatever topic people are concerned about, and I'm happy to stand at a podium or address Congress or go before the European Union and talk about it. I've done all those things. But after that, I like to be by myself with my kids. I think that's where I'm best suited.
Yeah, the
But of course, everybody has different skill sets, and those
absolutely.
Who are more gregarious, I leave the politics to those folks.
Well, that's the scary thing, because I think a lot of the ones that are leading us really don't know or don't understand. It's really hard to trust so many of them.
Well, you know, their hearts and minds can be changed, and I've seen that happen. So here's a little story from my testimony before the New York Assembly the other week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's connected with food. I belong to a CSA here in the Finger Lakes region. We are, of course, a hot spot for organic agriculture, and as part of that, we actually have a CSA bakery, meaning that there are heirloom wheat strains that have been reintroduced into upstate New York. We used to be the breadbasket for the whole Northeast in the old days, and so some farmers have resurrected all those ancient strains of wheat, and we now have farmers giving their grain to a local mill that we have in my own little village, and then there are artisanal bakers who have used to have figured out how to use old recipes to make wheat from this. It's kind of low gluten, the flour,
mm-hmm.
and so they have to do it in a special way. So we get, as part of a CSA, we actually get bread from the CSA bakery every week. And in addition, this flour is actually sold to bakeries as far as away as Brooklyn, and they're turned into kind of artisanal loaves of bread. And so, unfortunately, all of the land surrounding these wheat fields, these organic wheat fields, are leased up to the fracking company. And so the mill would like to hire, because we have more demand than we can possibly supply,
mm-hmm.
but the farmers can't expand because of the gas leases.
Mm.
So here we are, we can't produce food because we plan to blast methane out of the ground. And so the baker asked if I would take into Albany, into the hearing room, a loaf of bread, and
mm-hmm.
talk about, and he had a message that he wanted me to give about this bread. And so I delivered it and then handed the loaf of bread to the senator, who said, you know, reminded me that they can't accept gifts, as though I were attempting to bribe,
mm-hmm.
to offer a bribe. And I said, no, the farmer said this is his testimony. The words are the bread, right?
Mm.
And so we piled the, on all these stacks of reports, we piled this loaf of bread as the submission to Albany to consider. And the message that the farmer offered me to deliver on his behalf was that bread, the flour and the yeast in bread is really just a way to make water stand up. And he cannot make bread without a source of clean water, and he can't get a source of flour if all of the land is going to be blown apart by frackers. And he wants to hire more in his bakery. The mill wants to hire more. So the economic opportunities are there, and it's actually going to be a loss of jobs if,
mm-hmm.
if we get, you know, this goes through. And so it was a very powerful moment, and I felt like by having the senator accept my bread, there's something more, some other transaction just happened there. It was a very human moment.
Yeah, we need a lot more of that. I love that story. You know, it all comes down to such simple things, bread and water.
Yeah, I mean, bread and water compared to natural gas,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe, especially since the best science shows us that if we invested in wind and solar, we could actually get off of fossil fuels within 30 years, entirely run our economy on renewables, not include nuclear in the mix, but the key is we have to reduce our consumption by half.
Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to be doable, too, with redesigns in engineering and chemistry. So it's very exciting. I mean, all kinds of exciting things could be happening, but there are those who seek to have us believe that we have no other choice but to kind of keep walking down the same suicidal path of running everything, you know, getting all of our energy from the bit of a drill. And I really think it's time to take our counsel from somewhere else now.
So you've been raising your kids, and I'm sure you've been participating in a variety of school events and meeting different parents. What is their reaction to you and all the things that you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I don't always talk about these things at the soccer line,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, backstage during play practice or during the piano recital rehearsal or any of that. But I am amazed that all of us are, you know, who are conscientious parents, really have a hard time having a discussion about the things that are really threatening our children. And I think it's because we feel like we want to protect our own kids from this bad news. We don't really want them to know that, you know, that the plankton, the world's plankton is in trouble now. Plankton has declined by 40%, and over the last 50 years, plankton makes us half of our oxygen. It seems like we should all be having a discussion about what's going on with plankton and why. But we don't really want our kids to overhear this, and so we end up, as parents, being in the same kind of bubble of protection that we put our children in, you know, this sort of hear no evil, see no evil. So I write a lot about that in Raising Elijah, like how can we talk about this parent to parent with each other. And I'm not sure I exactly know the answer, but I do know that even children themselves are beginning to realize that there's something wrong, you know, that it shouldn't, the weather is just too weird. And even if you're 9 years old, you know, the daffodils aren't supposed to be blooming in January. So as children ask us questions, we really need to kind of come up with another sort of big talk that's a different big talk than telling them about the story of sex and how, where babies come from and how families are created. And this big talk is about kind of the ongoing decreation of the earth created by, caused by climate change. And so I write a lot about Raising Elijah about how to have an age-appropriate conversation about those topics. But in fact, I think the most important thing that we can do as parents is not really talk about them, but let our children see us stand up and take action. And I'm really moved by a story that I heard that I then repeat in Raising Elijah from a retired third grade teacher who was teaching 8-year-olds during the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s. Mm. And her students were all really sure that nuclear war was going to happen in their lifetimes. And there was one child who was sure it wasn't. She was the only one in the class. And so the teacher asked, well, what makes you think it's not? And she said, because my parents are peace activists and they're working to stop it. So in fact, this child was not so upset because her parents were actually on the job. And so I think the way we reassure our children about their safety is not to pretend that we're not living in the middle of a crisis, but let our children see that we're not good Germans. We're actually members of the French Resistance here. We're paying attention to the signs of atrocity, and we're actively working to stop it. And that's what's reassuring to kids. So with that, you see me in the middle of the book as a character in my own book take an entirely different tack. And I stopped trying to hide my own research from my kids and let them see me, you know, take my son with me when I go lobby in Congress. Let them see what I'm trying to do here. And that's actually been a really good shift for my own family.
I think that's so important. It's important for parents to be honest. It's important for parents and adults to know that they should be doing things, fighting for things that aren't right, and also letting kids know that it will be up to them and that they, yes, they can solve these problems. So it's all kind of like a perspective and mindset. But I think so many people are just feeling it's all futile, it's all too insurmountable and too difficult, and then pass that on to their children. And that's
right.
That's
yeah.
the danger.
And that's the danger. And so there is actually this phenomenon called well-informed futility syndrome that psychologists, there's a whole body of information about, and it was originally, it was a term you originally described to talk about people during the Vietnam War who watched a lot of the war on television, and they turned out to be they felt less able to cope with thinking that they could do anything about it than people who watched less television. And so the phenomenon is that the more you know, the more futile you feel sometimes, if you have a steady drumbeat of bad, you know, bad news. And so people don't want to feel despair and don't want to feel afraid or guilty, and so they turn away from these intolerable feelings by simply going into denial. And I think that's what we're seeing now with climate change. And of course, that's not helpful either. So you see in Raising Elijah, me talking about how to get out of this box of well-informed futility syndrome. How can we be well-informed but not feel futile? And so I try to march everyone out of this box. But, you know, I'm not exactly a cheerleader for this, and I'm not immune to it either. And there's one story I tell in one of the later chapters of Raising Elijah in which Elijah asked me at age 4 if he could be a polar bear for Halloween. And I actually have some pretty good sewing skills because I have a background in animal surgery. So I set to work sewing a costume out of an old chenille bedspread. And it was, and at some point I realized it was with the knowledge that this costume would probably outlast the species. And that night when we were out on the streets of my village, I saw all these other children dressed up as species that were vanishing. You know, bumblebees, monarch butterflies, penguins, bats, all these species are in trouble. And so I began to wonder, you know, our children are so, feel such kinship for certain animals. Their stories are all about these animals. They become them for Halloween. And what does it mean that we're living in the midst of this great extinction with one in every four mammals now heading for extinction, and we're not having a public conversation about that?
I think it's so part of human nature, part of our survival tactic is this denial thing that's built into us that gets us through a lot of difficult things. But I think it's not working out right now.
It's not working out, and that's not what we tell our children, right? So we tell our children that if you see something wrong, somebody's being bullied, you tell someone, you stand up. If anyone touches you inappropriately and tells you to keep a secret, you don't keep that secret. And so I think our silence and complicity around environmental destruction is actually working in the opposite direction of the lessons that we're teaching them about everything else. And so we need to get all these things in alignment.
Now, my particular passion is food and everything all around it, and I'm a big advocate against factory farming. And that's something that I know a lot of parents don't want to talk to their children about where their food really comes from, because some of it is really so sci-fi horrific.
Mm-hmm.
You don't talk about that in this book. I don't know if you've talked about it in other books, but is there a reason for that? Because that whole industry is so polluting.
It is. I chose a sort of good news tack in raising Elijah because I happen to live in an area that, at least right now, pre-fracking, offers this incredible array of local organic agriculture. So what instead I do is show readers how my own children growing up in this actually makes some really good food choices now. I mean,
I loved your kale story.
My kale story, yeah. So my 3-year-old threw a temper tantrum because he really wanted kale one day. He just laid down right on the floor of the food co-op and kicked and screamed, and the whole groups of people gathered around to see a 3-year-old throw a tantrum over a dark green leafy vegetable. We were in there to buy shampoo, and he really wanted kale, and I wouldn't give it to him. So, but I think my kids are only a sample size of two, but what I was interested in this book is showing readers that when you don't have children advertised to by the food industry, decided we don't have television and they don't do a lot of screen time in my house, and when you buy the food directly from the farmer and you're invested in a CSA, and the kids like to go and see their carrots and pick their strawberries, that actually they fall in love with these very colorful, healthy foods. And it's sort of food habits that will serve them, I hope, for a lifetime. And so the kind of so-called inconvenience of sourcing your food locally as opposed to just heading down to the supermarket is more than made up for in my household, because I don't have picky eaters. I don't have to short order cook. I just make one meal for the whole family, and we all pretty much enjoy it. I mean, there's a few foods that my son now, Elijah, won't. He's off of asparagus because he doesn't like stinky pea. He didn't have a problem with it last year, but suddenly he's boycotting, asparagus. So, all right, that's fine. I can, go around the asparagus. I don't force anybody to eat anything. But for the most part, my life is made easier by children who have good eating habits, because I can take them anywhere and they can just eat whatever's served to them. They have adventurous palates, and food is a lot of fun in our household.
Well, I got to have to give you and your husband credit for that, because you raise your kids this way, and it's not normal today in society to live the way that you do.
Well, I mean, it's not, and I have to say that a lot of these things are happy accidents, and so I want to, in the book, it's certainly not all about this sort of self-righteous adoration of pure food, which I find some of that writing a little bit insufferable. But the truth of the matter is the television was stolen out of the back of the moving van, and we just never replaced it.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of it is we ended up moving into...
But you chose not to replace it.
We chose not to replace it, and we ended up living, you know, within a half a mile of a CSA, so
mm-hmm.
we can go...
I mean, most people, if they lost their TV, they would buy one in a half hour.
Well,
no
I guess
question.
That might be true. But I set in motion, kind of in unintentionally, a human experiment, you know,
mm-hmm.
raising my kids without being advertised to by the food industry, and then it turns out that when they did end up at a McDonald's, they didn't like it
mm-hmm.
Because they didn't... hadn't been told that it was all
yeah.
this thing that they were supposed to like. And so my son actually burst into tears because when he opened his yellow and red package, inside was food that was all brown. And he burst into tears and said, it's all, you know, it's too brown. So it's brown bun, brown hamburger, brown Coke, brown fries. And so he's used to colorful bell peppers or sweet potatoes and things like that. And it was also oversalted for their palates. You know,
yep.
they're just not used to that. So, it was a lesson to me that junk food is not inherently attractive. In fact, most of it's kind of ugly looking. And it's only made attractive by advertising and packaging. And so if you don't let your kids get advertised to, then they find
it's amazing.
Food inherently more attractive.
Yeah, it's amazing what can happen. And, you know, all kids are human experiments.
yeah.
Whether you
I
do it consciously
true.
Or not. So, gosh, there's so many great stories in this book, so many things to talk about, and we have about 3 minutes left.
Okay.
So you make these three recommendations: plant a garden, mow grass without the assistance of fossil fuels, and replace the clothes dryer with evaporation. We talked about the clothes dryer. We kind of touched on planting a garden, and I think there's a big movement with food these days, urban gardens and community gardens, and this is a good thing, and I can't encourage it enough for people to try and grow anything, even in an apartment, just something small. Just get things growing. The mowing grass, I chuckled at it, but it really is an important thing. There are just so many people need to think about everything they do.
Yeah, it's fun to do it, right? So
mm-hmm.
I think this is a good note to close on. I mow half an acre with a little reel mower. And the good news here is these things have all been redesigned since you last saw your grandfather's reel mower.
Mm.
So they're actually very easy to use. I do a whole ergonomic analysis. It's about the same amount of energy that is pushing a fully loaded stroller.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do it with your kids out in the yard, which when I had a baby and a toddler, I couldn't leave them alone in the house while I mowed, nor could I, you know, have them under the tree while I pushed through the yard this 100 decibel rock spewing smog making machine. And so a push mower actually saves me time, and I can multitask. So I can oversee like a trampoline party while cutting my grass. It offers me a chance to get some cardio exercise done. I try to do an hour a day. And so I began to realize that my reel mower was like a machine in a gym, and if you tricked it out with a cup holder and a cardio monitor, you could actually, people would pay to push this thing around.
That's right. It's just got to be made hip.
It's got to be made hip. Yeah, you just have to think differently, I think. And there's real joy and fun in doing that. And, of course, it's part of my message to my children that, hey, I'm on the job. I care about your environment. I'm not going to fill your air up with smog and fill this, you know, mower gasoline tank up with tar sands or Saudi Arabian oil just to cut grass. We
yeah.
can do this in a different way.
There's a lot
it's
of a people,
big
though.
Message.
There's a lot of people, though, that live in suburbia and either have gardeners taking care of their lawns or they have those big, giant mowers that they sit on to mow their lawns. There's a lot of work that needs to be done.
A lot of work to be done. But I think if there were landscape architects, you know, with push mowers,
mm-hmm.
I bet there would be a market for that.
That's right. Okay. Let's start the push mower movement. My brother uses one. I don't have property, so
right.
If I did, I would use a push mower. Gosh, thank you so much. I encourage the listeners to go to your website, steingrabber.com. You're blogging, and you write for Huffington Post, I think.
I do. I haven't posted there for a little while since Raising Elijah came out. I've been sort of busy on the book tour, but I'll get back to it soon.
Yes, so many great things that you've put out, and thank you for this book, and thank you for setting a model. You walk the walk. You know, you can preach because you practice what you preach. So I think it's a good thing.
Well, let's get your listeners to stop fracking. So I'll close by saying, everybody, please call Governor Cuomo and put an end to this.
Right on. Call Cuomo, stop fracking.
That's it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me. And please remember, call Governor Cuomo and let's stop fracking. Thanks for listening.